Hello there, my name is Chris Kirk and welcome to TW Talks, the interviews podcast from Free Weeks Edinburgh. We are at Edinburgh Festival 2023. I have set myself up in a little room just next to the Bristow Square, George Square hub of the fringe, and I am grabbing a load of people who are performing at the festival this year to talk past, present and future. The story so far, this year's show, and what's happening next. Today, Andre de Freitas, who has a show at Pleasance Courtyard called What If? I think of all the shows I've seen at the festival this year, personally, it was my favourite. It's a really, really good show. I gave it 5 out of 5. So about halfway through the festival, I managed to sit down to find out more about the show and the story behind it and what's coming next. So here it is. Let's get TW talking with Andre de Freitas. Okay, we're back with our next interview here at Edinburgh Festival 2023. I'm joined by Andre de Freitas, although you're from Portugal.
Yes.
In case there are any Portuguese people listening, I've just pronounced your name wrong.
No, you pronounce it very well.
I pronounce it in a way that our English-speaking listeners will now know what to look for on a poster.
Exactly that, yes.
But if I was to say it properly in Portuguese, it would be?
It would be Andre de Freitas.
Okay. It sounds, you know, more exotic.
Although, does it?
Well, one of the things you talk about in your show is that Portuguese doesn't sound very
exotic. No, not even my name sounds nice. You know? I think my name sounds nicer in English than it's in Portuguese.
In your show, well, we're getting ahead of ourselves here a bit, but in your show, you talk about how Brazilian Portuguese does sound exotic.
Yeah, so let me tell you, I'll tell you my name, and if they would say it in Brazilian, be like, André de Freitas.
Yeah.
André de Freitas. That sounds nicer, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely sounds more Spanish, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. In the way, well, I guess the way the Spanish would say, well, it'd be similar to that, I guess. Yeah, but it sounds nicer. Yeah.
But anyway,
more open.
But I think the way I said it, what's important is that people know when they look at the poster.
Exactly.
That yes. is you. So we're here to talk past, present, and future. So story so far, this year's show, and where you're hoping to take things next. Although this year's show is, in essence, your story of your journey through comedy.
That's right. So my show's pinnacle, if you will, is me being here. So it just tells everything I've gone through in order to do this. So, you know, I've told stories from even before I started doing stand-up properly to the idea of wanting to do stand-up. And then I talk through sort of my whole journey of what it's been like to try to be a full-time stand-up. And then ultimately ending up here at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So the show tells all of that. And I hope it does so with a lens of optimism, because that's the idea of the show.
And one thing that's very clear, well, certainly from the way you tell it in the show, is you decided, not only did you decide that you wanted to be a stand-up comedian, and that's quite an ambitious thing, but you were in Portugal. But it seemed to me that being a stand-up comedian in either the US or the UK was actually the ambition.
Yes, that's right. So at the time, when I first told my parents I wanted to do stand-up comedy, they didn't understand what it was. It just wasn't a thing. That they were like, what is that? And he goes, I go on a stage and I tell jokes. I had to explain literally what it was. And he goes, like an actor. And he goes, yeah, but it's not a play and I write it myself. And then I have to be funny. And then my dad's like, but I don't think you're very funny. And I'm like, wait till you hear it in English. And he goes, you're doing it in English. And he goes, and my parents have, my mother understands English well enough. My dad, so-so. So for them, the idea of me wanting to do something that they didn't even know the concept of in a language they barely sort of know was just the most alien thing in the world. So not only has been the journey in order to sort of do this, but also the journey of kind of taking them along this ride and be like, this is what it is. And now after all these years, they understand it better. And they're like, they call me now and they go, you know, how was the show? You know, he goes, my dad sometimes every now and again, he'll come to a show and be like, tough crowd today, you know? And it's just like something that I'm like, I've never imagined my dad saying, or he was like, they were great today. They really laughed at that bit. And then he tries to sort of recreate the bit, but he doesn't speak English well enough to do it. So he goes, I know what you're talking about. But he goes, yeah, they like that that text. Yeah, so it's very interesting. I think when you're from a different country and you sort of decide to try to make your career, whether in the UK or in the US, there's a lot of suspicion coming from the family.
And initially you went to New York first before London?
So yeah, well, Chris, I'm gonna have to be honest here, where I actually went to LA, but in order for the show to fit better, I mentioned New York, because I went to New York after.
Right.
But I was first.
A little bit of poetic license on the storyline.
I took some yes, I took some license just to make the
when
show.
When you do closer. The 2-hour version, you can put LA back in.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's let me tell you, you've seen the show, talk about this portion where I live in the car, and it's much easier to live in a car in LA than it is in New York. Because in New York, everyone complains it's hard to find parking spots. Whereas LA, very, very open.
And were there British or American comedians that was one of the reasons why that you wanted to do comedy in English, in an English-speaking country, rather than trying to make a Korean comedy or something similar back home?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first and foremost, I think English is a much better sounding language for the arts in general, for music and for comedy. So for example, the rhythm of a joke in English will go na-na-na, na-na-na, and people understand that rhythm. Portuguese, being a Latin language, the language isn't so flexible as English is, so the significance of words is more set in stone. So for example, you could have a joke in Portuguese that would be like na-na-na, na-na-na-na-na, and that pace just isn't as good. And then I think what I saw coming out of the UK and the US just felt more like, oh, these are the big dogs, and I want to just kind of be there and try to achieve my potential without wanting to sound too, you know. And I just felt Portugal would always have a ceiling, and there would be a small ceiling. Yeah.
And I guess, and obviously this is something you talk about in the show, because almost pursuing a career in comedy is a difficult thing to do. Performing in a second language is a difficult thing to do. And just making enough money to survive in a foreign land where you're still learning how everything works is a difficult thing to do. Yeah. And I guess you've got all of those three things coming together. So you'll set yourself a massive challenge. And as you've already alluded to, your sense that your family's definitely recognized you were setting yourself a ludicrous challenge.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Every step of the way, they were like, you're an idiot. What you're doing makes no sense. And it just took years and years to even sort of get them to sort of see that I was really passionate about this and kind of just willing to suffer. And I think this is, you know, it can vary. I used to hang out always with, I made a lot of friends with Europeans, sort of people who moved here, working in cafes, etc., and they're living in the UK. And one of the things that's very difficult sometimes is the parents' frustration of not being able to help their kids and seeing them struggle. So I knew it was very hard for my parents. I hid a lot of things from my parents. I hid a lot of the struggle from my parents because I knew it would be frustrating for them to just hear it and not be able to help me financially. So obviously, if you've got a Portuguese wage, but you're living in London, there's just not money enough to spare, and the money won't go a long way. So I think a lot of Europeans do this, and I think, or first-time immigrants, doesn't matter. Europeans is just more of what I know, but I think first-time immigrants, they hide a lot of their struggles from their families because unless your family is wealthy, the frustration of not being able to help can be hard.
Now, in the show, you talk about the highs and the lows, a lot more of the lows than the highs in that early stage of trying to make it in the US and the UK. And then I guess one bit that is, I guess, relatable to every single person in the room in a way is that after various, working hard, particularly in London, things were just starting to gain some momentum.
Yeah.
At the start of 2020.
That's right.
And we exactly. All know what then happened next.
Yes.
Is just as things were starting to build, suddenly the world shuts down and then you go back to Portugal again
that's
during
right.
the pandemic.
Yeah. So that's all true. I I felt like after sort of years of just this ridiculous self-belief, I think that's always been the thing that as drove me, is just this just insane idea that I felt I could do it. And then, yes, of course, as soon as the pandemic happens, I had to move back to Portugal, which was nice. I mean, it was unexpected. And I didn't think I would be coming back to Portugal. And then I sort of discovered my hometown had changed. It had become more gentrified. A lot of people actually moved to Portugal, to Lisbon, close to where I live. It became sort of a very different city. So it's been interesting to see that change as well. And for those 2 years, I lived back in Portugal, and the idea was always to come back immediately after to the UK as soon as things opened up. But when you're busy making plans, life happens, right?
And then I get the sense that once you were back in Portugal, actually, despite your original plan of, in order to make it in comedy, I need to go to London, I need to go to New York, LA, or wherever, actually, you started to find a way of having success in comedy back at home.
Yeah, weirdly, things started to happen. Some opportunities started coming, not only just in Portugal, but around Europe. So I started getting invited to do a lot of gigs abroad in Europe. And then I came up with an idea in Portugal. And I mean, this idea was something we did in a beach bar once. And then the concept just took off. And then a year later, we're doing a national tour and filling out theaters. And then a little podcast became like a big thing. So next thing I know, I've found some level of success, not only through the projects, but through sort of online, etc., that I just never expected, or was just never even something that I pursued. I mean, that's the sort of irony of things, is whatever I pursued always slapped me in the face. But then when I was just there, things happen, right? And that's I guess that's the nature of things, right?
I think it's very common, is if you talk to people who've had success in any, whether it's comedy or music or whatever, often, you know, they've worked really hard, they've done everything, they've done all of the new talent competitions and the open mic nights and the blah, blah, blah. And then when you say, you know, why did that gig come along? Or why did that video go viral? Or why did that happen? It's like, we don't really know. It just happened.
Exactly.
There's probably a manager or an agent somewhere who will take responsibility for it. But in reality, it's just occasionally things align and they work.
Yes, everybody wants to be the one that said, I discovered this guy. But I don't think there's anything such as being discovered. Certainly not in my case, where I was like, hey, you've just took notice. But I've been plugging away for... it was never easy, I guess, is the thing. So the idea of being discovered, I'm like, there's just been a lot of work. And I think you'll find that a lot of artists that are way, 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 way more successful than me will tell you that. We're gonna be like, they say, oh my God, you just popped up out of nowhere. And you'd be like, no, that, you know, I've been going for 10 years.
Exactly, yeah, the 10-year overnight success.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I'm hoping that things are kind of changing, are in that shift. But again, it's interesting. I mean, I talk about this in the show as well, and hopefully, you know, if the story interests people, that they would like to come. But it's ironic to have success in a place that you never really wanted the success. So in a way, coming to Edinburgh was sort of a rejection of that success, because I felt that success wasn't mine. I felt what I had worked towards was here in the UK, and it was here in the UK, and that's where I felt like my dues were. I felt like I needed to reap the rewards of the work that I'd been doing here, rather than just kind of getting lucky. And I think there was always, I think that the fear is that, or when I was in Portugal, I had very clear in my head that I'm like, if I stay here, I will never achieve my full potential. And I think a lot of people can be happy with that. but because my show, my show's called What If, right? So I always think like, what if I don't achieve my full potential? Like, even if I fail, I want to know
you tried,
that I really gave it a go, and that I did my best, and that I went to the top of what my potential could be. And I think when you live in a small country, I've talked about this with other people that live in small countries. We call it small country syndrome, right? Where the country celebrates people who've done it abroad.
Yeah.
Very much.
Yeah.
Because they almost don't recognize their own sort of people. So there's almost this way that there's so many stories of, oh, this person had to go abroad for us to realize what we had,
yes,
or et cetera, et cetera. Because
if foreigners like it, it must be good.
Exactly that. That's right. You're totally right, Chris. Yes, exactly.
And once you decided that you were going to come to the Fringe, you were going to do the full hour show, I mean, was it immediately obvious to you that telling that story and making the show, in essence, the conclusion of the story, was that obvious from the start, or did you play around before you came up with that concept?
Not at all. Not at all. When I first as any comedian, when you sort of be like, okay, I have whatever amount of material and I feel ready to do it. But then when you, Edinburgh, it's its own beast in a way, where when you put together an Edinburgh show, it's maybe different than a comedian who's already very famous putting a show to tour theaters or whatever. So the show has changed sort of structurally, as in what it was about. It changed about three times. And then one day I just had the sort of what if idea, and I talked to the person who helped me with my show, sort of directed it, and he goes, I think this is the path, and I think you finishing the show there, that makes total sense. So once we have found that, we sort of played around, but there was many versions of the show, and it just took a long time to kind of put it together in a way that I was happy with, and that I felt that it was also representative. Because not only that is, a lot of the stories that I tell in the show were sort of very, there were dark moments for me. Some moments were difficult. So there was always also the aspect of like, do I want to tell these stories? Do I want to?
Well, and I thought that when you see the show, and I know almost certainly which bits you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it is like, and obviously, in the context of the show, they're very funny.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, okay, well, presumably we're allowed to laugh because you're making a joke of it. But also, I guess, and probably for yourself, is it with hindsight you can see the humor in the situation, but maybe less so at the time?
No, even at the time, I could see that this would be funny. But like, once going through something and realizing it's funny, but then also then just kind of being past it enough that you can write it into being funny. There are two different things, right? You can see the funny, but then actually putting it onto a bit, for example. There are two different things. Like, I talk about my family a lot in the show as well. So, I also wanted to make sure that, I talked to them before I included them in the show, particularly in this case, my uncle was a figure in the show that I discussed. Because I wanted to make sure that I treated their parts, sort of their illnesses, with the same respect that as I treated my own stories. So there was just very much a sort of like, if I'm doing the show, it's because for me, these things are resolved. But with this being said, I do look forward to recording the show, hopefully. And then I think when the show comes out publicly, I feel like that chapter will be closed finally. And I
so looking to the future, presumably you have you'd like to do other hour shows, other full shows down the line, but you think that you'll say, okay, I've that story is now out there. It's saved for everyone to see and enjoy. And the next time you're going to talk about something else.
Yeah. So I think that's it. I think in a way, because I'm doing the show every day, even though I have the sort of distance now from some of the stories I tell, I am still doing the show. So I think I'm in my head, I'm still living in this chapter of my life. Whereas once the show is finished and is recorded and is out into the world, I feel like that part of the book's closed.
Yeah.
And I can turn the page over and start thinking about who am I now? Who am I now post all of that? Hopefully, things will be better in my career that I won't need to go back to some of the things that I mentioned in the show or some of the difficulties that I mentioned in the show. So then it's a process of just rediscovering yourself again and who are you again?
Yeah.
And what do you believe in? And what are your thoughts on things? And what do you feel like you would like to talk about? Now, I do want to do another hour show, of course. I mean, I think that's the game, right? You do it, you close it, and you start again. But we also live in a digital age where the majority of comedians, the majority of performers really, are trying to build an audience. So this idea that you'll have maybe an amazing Edinburgh Fringe, and then the next day you'll be on live at the Apollo, and that'll change your life, that's no longer the case. So you have to think in sort of more marketing terms of like, okay, are people really going to give me an hour of their time on their screens? Maybe not. So, but would they give me 15 minutes of their time 4 times a year? So perhaps I'm thinking, okay, in building an hour show, great, but or is it better to just build really strong chunks of comedy? Build an audience, and with that audience, then they're more inclined to give me their time, to give me an hour of their time, and to pay for a ticket to come and see me. So I'm
adapting to how people are consuming comedy in 2023.
That's right. Yeah. So I think there's a big sort of crossroads moment in the entertainment business right now, where obviously content is king. And you want to do the hour. The hour is artistically satisfying. But if ultimately you have no audience and no followers, people just won't come to see you. And then the weight of industry isn't as big as it used to be. So what is your other way? Is you go towards a sort of more lenient, closed approach where you're just putting out smaller chunks of content, but you're putting out more regularly and you're accumulating people so that you get to a point where you have enough people that they're like, I would like to now listen to you talk for an hour. So it's maybe changed.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
So it used to be that you do an hour to maybe get a 15-minute slot. And I think maybe now it's like, do a lot of 15-minute slots in order to earn the right
to do the hour.
To do the hour.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? I'd love, because obviously you've been in the business for a long time. You've seen a lot of shows. What are your thoughts on this?
No, I completely agree, and I think it's interesting with comedians coming through. I think I say it in a slightly different way, but I think I'm saying the same thing. That comedy used to be, as opposed to say the music industry, an industry where it was all live until the BBC or Channel 4 came, and then you started doing recorded content. Whereas it's kind of flipped. And now people are starting out by doing their TikTok, Instagram, YouTube content, or they've got a podcast, and they're building an online audience with recorded content on which they build a live career.
Yeah.
And I completely agree. And I think the industry is still figuring out what to do with that. Because the old approach was the approach for so long.
Yeah, I think comedians have always had this, they've always been agile in how they move. Because if you sort of look at comedy, maybe compared to some other, there's not many grants for comedians.
Yeah.
So comedians have always been like very, what do I gotta do? So they're very quick on change. Whereas I have a lot of friends in the theater that really their shows still depend very much on government grants.
Yeah.
Or on this, or on sort of patrons at the arts and stuff. So they're slightly less agile. They don't move as quickly as comedians. And I think comedians, because they have that constant need of, I need to figure out a way, they move quicker. And I think hopefully the industry can sort of maybe learn from what the comedians are doing and maybe adjust to that. And I think a lot of comedians are sort of looking more towards being independent, you know, having an agent, having a manager doesn't matter as much as it used to matter, right? Now what matters more is who's your videographer? Do you have a media team? Do you have someone that you can work with on creating content? And what does your content look like? It's almost like all of us are a mini production company and everybody's trying to build a brand and everybody's trying to recruit a mini team to sort of put their things out. So hopefully in order to earn the hour, if that makes sense. So I think, yeah, I think we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, no, it'll be fascinating to see how you progress with that. And as you say, how the comedy community at large.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, have you seen, or in your opinion, have you seen any sort of change of the tide from the industry? Any sort of like realizations that we'll go, okay, this is completely different. We need to change radically.
I think the industry is still real, because only really in the last few years I think this realization has come about, and I think everyone is trying to learn what you do with that, and therefore what is the role of this festival.
Yeah,
I think the role of this festival changes, and that's fascinating, but I think it is still, everyone is still sort of figuring it out. On one level, that's exciting. It's exciting that new ways of doing things.
Absolutely. I think you touch on a really good point there about the festival, because as the festival is getting more expensive, it's becoming less affordable for a lot of people to come. And then if you sort of look at, you'll have, say, maybe what in this festival, maybe 15 huge social media stars that will sell out their entire runs. And then you perhaps have like sort of comic veterans who can perhaps even deliver a better hour, struggling to get people in. So the level playing field has also changed. You have a completely different... I do think comedians in general have a great advantage, which is it's much easier to make performers social media people than it is to make a social media person a performer.
Yeah.
Because it just takes so long, the craft of stand-up, it just takes so long, you know? You can be 10 years into comedy and you can be a newcomer. You know, I know a couple of people here in this festival that are debuting, but they've been going though for over a decade. So just kind of nailing that the live comedy takes a long time. And even now when I'm like, okay, I've delivered this piece of work, which is sort of autobiographical. I talked about what I know. I talked about my journey. But then now there's a sort of, once this chapter is closed, which I haven't really thought about too much, but once that chapter is closed, I got to reassess. Now, who am I as a comedian? What do I want to say? Do I want to be silly? Do I want to be funny? Do I want to make any points? Like, so you're also changing as a performer. So I think that there's just a lot of change happening in general.
No, I think, as I say, it'll be fascinating to see how you take that. But also, I think for the industry at large, the fact that everything is in flux is exciting, but also confusing.
Yes, absolutely.
But we should wrap up with the current show by plugging the current show,
because
it's brilliant. So just tell us the name, the venue, where people can see it.
Absolutely. So the show is called What If. It's at the Pleasance Bunker 2 at 8:10 p.m.
And where can people follow you online for information on this show, but all that journey?
Yes, absolutely. Great question. I'm on Andre Comedy, A-N-D-R-E Comedy on Instagram, and at the Andre De Freitas on TikTok. However, if you just go to my Instagram, you click a link there, and you can buy tickets to the Edinburgh show. You can follow me on the other social platforms if you like. So that's where I'll be located, and then just roaming the streets of Edinburgh.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.